This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Gang wars, regular wars, death squads, natural disaster. There's no excuse immigrants won't summon to seek entry to our shores. But don't worry, our White House isn't buying any of it. Not last year or last week or this week.
I don't want to allow people that weren't supposed to be in the Bahamas to come into the United States, including some very bad people and some very bad gang members.
Last Sunday, some Bahamians fleeing the devastation of Hurricane Dorian were kicked off ferries because they lacked visas. On Wednesday,
the U.S. Supreme Court says the Trump administration can begin denying asylum seekers refuge while a legal fight on the rule continues. The policy is meant to deny asylum to anyone who passes through another country to the U.S.
In other words, to apply for asylum at the southern border, you must have first applied for safe haven anywhere else. This after 13 states filed a lawsuit last month against the president's new public charge rule, set to take effect next month, a rule that could deny green cards and visas to legal immigrants.
If the Trump administration believes that there is any possibility that a legal immigrant might at any point in that immigrant's life, even temporarily, rely on government benefits like food stamps, Medicaid, or housing assistance.
When the policy was announced last month, Acting Citizenship and Immigration Services Director Ken Cuccinelli was queried on NPR's Morning Edition.
Would you also agree that Emma Lazarus's words etched on the Statue of Liberty, "Give me your tired, your poor," are also part of the American ethos?
They certainly are. Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own 2 feet and who will not become a public charge. That plaque was put on the Statue of Liberty at almost the same time as the first public charge law was passed. Very interesting timing.
It's not the first time that a member of Trump's team was slapped with that line from the poem, The New Colossus.
What you're proposing, or what the president's proposing here, does not sound like it's in keeping with American tradition when it comes to immigration.
2 years ago, when proposing a policy favoring English-speaking immigrants, senior policy advisor Stephen Miller was confronted by CNN's Jim Acosta.
The Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. It doesn't say anything about speaking English.
I don't want to get off into a whole thing about history here, but the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of liberty enlightening the world. It's a symbol of American liberty lighting the world. The poem that you're referring to that was added later is not actually part of the original Statue of Liberty.
There?
When I told people I was working on the Statue of Liberty, a lot of people just kind of rolled their eyes or shrugged their shoulders.
Paul Kramer is a professor of history at Vanderbilt University who's written about the statue's multifarious meanings. You can hear we're on a boat and we're headed for Liberty Island. It's September 11th. The day is hot, the way is clear, and she is magnificent.
I think it's become so much a part of kind of kitsch and popular culture, right? We just got pretzels, and there are souvenirs of the Statue of Liberty and, right, foam headgear. And so we've lost track of how weird the statue is, that there would be this enormous icon in the harbor that people continue to fight and wrestle over it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard Miss Liberty.
It's amazing how close it is. Over there next to it is
Ellis Island.
That's Ellis Island.
Yeah, I mean, the sequence that people would come in on the boat, they would see the statue first, and then they would stop at Ellis Island and have to get off and be checked, and roughly 2% of immigrants were deported and not allowed to land, so there was a lot of fear.
For many, Liberty Enlightening the World, as the statue is officially titled, symbolized the freedom and opportunity that awaited them in their new land.
Yeah, so that contrast between kind of hope and terror is a big part of the immigrant narrative.
Food and gift services are located both aboard this vessel and in the shop near the ferry dock at Liberty Island.
It really is beautiful.
Yeah.
The sinews in her arms, she may not be a warrior, but she is strong. She is indomitable. And she seems to me to be suppressing her power, holding it back or holding it in reserve.
Yeah, I think there's a reason why when these contemporary nativists are trying to make these arguments for shutting down refugee programs, closing borders, etc., that they feel like they have to take her on. I mean, it is a sign of how powerful she is in public life and how powerful she's been made by the waves of people that have given her liberatory, emancipatory meanings, that they feel like they just have to wrestle with her, and she keeps fighting back.
The statue, dedicated in 1886, was pitched by the abolitionist and political thinker Édouard de La Boulaye as a gift from the French people to celebrate the Union's victory in the Civil War, the end of slavery in America, and the triumph of democratic and Enlightenment ideals.
And so after the Civil War, he's able to sort of say, okay, the United States has now perfected itself. It has now gotten slavery out of its system. And, you know, as a result, he is turning a blind eye to ongoing systems of racial oppression in the United States because they kind of need the United States to be a perfected republic.
If built as originally conceived, Lady Liberty would have held broken shackles and worn the Phrygian cap of emancipation. Now, the broken chains lay at her feet, nearly invisible, and the original message is likewise obscured. The timing was off.
There are freedom meanings that are clearly informing the spirit of the statue from the beginning, but they're deliberately modulated. And so I think part of what is striking is the ways that successive groups, immigrants, African Americans, other marginalized groups, will again and again have to kind of blow on the kindling of those freedom meanings in the statue to bring them to life, to kind of animate them. And there are crosswinds that are trying to blow those out. It's not a given that the statue is going to represent a robust, meaningful idea of freedom. It's something that has to be renewed and has to be recharged again and again. Americans have spent a lot of time over the last century Americanizing the statue, even to the point where it becomes, by some measures, the most sort of easily identifiable symbol of the nation. But there is something persistently kind of alien about the statue, beginning with its origins. And initially, Americans are not certain what to do with it. I mean, what does this gift entail? What do the French Republicans want from America?
A Trojan horse in the form of a very tall lady?
Yeah, there's a lot of question about that. And then, of course, the big issue is that Americans have to pony up for the pedestal. It takes longer than the Americans had promised, which is a little bit embarrassing, but eventually it comes together. So even from the beginning, there's this sense of, do we want this thing?
Finally, the funds for the base were raised through donations, vast and tiny. The poem, The New Colossus by Emma Lazarus, was her contribution, an auction item. 17 years passed before it was enshrined on the base, because the meaning of the Statue of Liberty has always flickered and shifted, though she's always been a potent symbol of something. The Statue of Liberty means precisely what you think it means. It also means the opposite. Kramer says that there are actually three statues: the Statue of the Guardian, the Statue of the Exile, and the Statue of the State, the Imperial Statue.
In some ways, the statue begins as what I'm calling the Guardian Statue, which is actually not an immigration symbol. It's a symbol of anti-immigration. This is a symbol of a certain kind of white exclusionary nation that is trying to protect itself from the world. If you look at some of the political cartoons from around the time the statue is built, it is understood by at least some commentators as a kind of guardian of the nation, standing at the threshold as a kind of police officer, as a kind of border control agent that is going to keep out the rabble, that is going to send a message that the United States is able to protect its borders.
early on, the most famous poem that's associated with the statue when it comes to immigration is not Emma Lazarus's poem, The New Colossus. It's Thomas Bailey Aldrich's The Unguarded Gate from 1892, and it's a rabidly xenophobic poem.
It refers to the statue as a white goddess,
yeah,
warning her of a wild, motley throng on the nation's doorstep, bringing their unknown gods and rites, strange tongues, and tiger passions here to stretch their claws.
Yeah, yeah, he's really going for broke there. I mean, other cases I found where the KKK at one point has a parade in Bellingham, Washington, and they put a picture of the Statue of Liberty on the back of a wagon. So the idea that the Statue of Liberty doesn't represent inclusion or racial justice or welcome to immigrants, I think, is an important part of the story.
Lady Liberty is carrying the light of liberty to the rest of the world.
Rush Limbaugh embraces the Guardian model.
It is not a beacon for immigrants to get to this country because they're tired, they're poor, they're huddled, hungry, or thirsty.
While the Guardian statue, for its proponents, is synonymous with a certain kind of racialized nation, the exile statue always remains offshore. It always remains at a kind of remove from the nation. It represents a universal value of welcome and freedom and sanctuary for the oppressed. The exile statue really begins with immigrants coming over on the boat. It's a sign that they have arrived in the United States. It's a sign of safety. It's a sign of optimism and hope. Soon, immigrants are putting the statue on their guidebooks that they send home to greenhorns that train them in how to kind of get by in America when they arrive. They send it on their postcards. It becomes a part of imagery so that people arriving expect the statue. It's no longer a discovery. It's a kind of expectation. But those meanings remain within immigrant cultures. They don't become a part of a kind of larger American public culture until later.
You've said that that Guardian statue period extended from its creation to around 1940, but it certainly overlapped then,
yes,
with the exile statue.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's this period between, say, you know, the 1920s, 1930s, and the 40s and 50s, where these two formations are kind of rivals in some important ways in public imagery.
Your huddled masses yearning to breathe free.
Irving Berlin warbling in 1949.
The wretched refuse of your teeming shore.
Writer, immigrant, anti-fascist Louis Adamek was in the vanguard of those who took up the Lazarus poem to promote the statue of exile. Diversity, he said, was the best defense against the real threat of fascism.
The idea that the strongest nations are ones that respect diversity, that encourage it, that don't require a coercive assimilation of immigrant groups, but that each group is able to contribute its unique spirit, its unique gifts to the nation as a whole.
To the farms of Iowa and Nebraska came the Scandinavians, and in smaller numbers the Slavs, the Italians, the Jews.
To the mills of New England come the French Canadians, the Irish, the Portuguese, the Slavs.
In radio programs like Americans All, Immigrants All in the late 30s, he strove to enshrine the statue of exile into the mainstream of American culture, against great odds, by making it part of an American national creed.
They built the roads, the canals, the railroads, and then the highways.
It can be a little embarrassing by contemporary sensibilities in the way that it kind of ties specific groups to their inner genius. But within the context of the time, it's clearly doing some very important egalitarian work.
But this is something of a mixed message, because even as it rejects the fearful bigotry of the Guardian statue in favor of the Statue of Exile, it also embraces the third statue in Paul Kramer's schematic, the imperial one.
One of the complicated things in any message about the statue is that often these three statues kind of intertwine with each other. And that's one reason why I think it's important to distinguish the exile statue from the imperial statue. Even though the imperial statue often ventriloquizes Emma Lazarus and kind of invokes Emma Lazarus to kind of give a generous humanitarian gloss, but ultimately it is about the utility of immigrants for the nation.
Later, President Johnson would celebrate immigrants at the foot of Lady Liberty by listing a series of the foreign-sounding names of soldiers who died in Vietnam.
Man named Fernandez and Zajac and Zelenko and Mariano.
Adamek did not live to see that, but Kramer thinks he would have found the spectacle grotesque.
The imperial statue is America. It is America sort of declaring itself as the exemplar of freedom throughout the world. Freedom is what the United States is. It isn't what America does and sometimes doesn't do.
Consider this invocation of the imperial statue during the statue's centennial in 1986, when there was a refugee crisis sparked by America's backing of dictatorship south of the border.
A light that tonight will shortly cast its glow upon her, as it has upon us for two centuries, keeping faith with a dream of long ago and guiding millions still to a future of peace and freedom.
I was able to find some quotations from reporters go to immigrant detention at the tip of Manhattan, and people in immigrant detention, including people fleeing some of these sort of U.S.-backed conflicts, are there, and they can hear the celebrations from within jail. And I just think that, in a way, is, I think, the imperial statue expressed in its essence, right, is the imagery of inclusion and celebration of immigrant social mobility and freedom and opportunity in a context where actual refugees are being subjected to violence and discrimination.
There was a newspaper cartoon for this period with a towering Statue of Liberty looking down at a disheveled person holding a suitcase, and the text says, "Give me your rich, your famous, your Nobel laureates, your Russian poets and Polish emissaries, your respectable white anti-Soviets yearning to breathe free."
And now we will unveil that gallant lady. Thank you and God bless you all.
As the sun beats down on Liberty Island, the solemn, gloriously green lady pierces the brilliant sky, but offers no shade. Many of the humans below cheerfully check off a box on their list of tourist sites. But back at her unveiling, the response was far more fraught. 200 women sailed to the island proclaiming that, quote, "In erecting a Statue of Liberty embodied as a woman in a land where no woman has political liberty, men have shown a delightful inconsistency." Only a few years earlier, the government had passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, our first big immigration law, and it was explicitly racist. It sparked the so-called driving out period, when Chinese were shot, stabbed, burned, and starved. As for African Americans, the black-owned Cleveland Gazette offered this editorial: "Shove the statue, torch and all, into the sea, until the liberty of this country is such as to make it possible for an inoffensive and industrious colored man in the South to earn a respectable living for himself and his family without being Ku Kluxed, perhaps murdered, his daughter and wife outraged, his property destroyed. The idea of the liberty of this country enlightening the world, or even Patagonia, is ridiculous in the extreme."
"We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal."
James Baldwin in the 80s.
"And the moment I do that, I'm in trouble again, because obviously I was not included in that pronouncement. That they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. That among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What is liberty? For a black American, for a black inhabitant of this country, the Statue of Liberty is simply a very bitter joke."
Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning and her name Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. "Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp," cries she with silent lips. "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore, send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, to me. I lift my lamp, beside the golden door.
One question I have, just thinking about the history of the changing meanings of the statue in immigration, is whether the statue will continue to be an important icon of immigration heading into the next century. The way that the memory of the statue is linked to the Lazarus poem has this very particular kind of relationship to European immigrants of the early 20th century. And one of the things that struck me when I was looking at the refugee crisis in the 80s is that there were sanctuary movement activists who invoked the statue and said, you know, the imperial statue of Reagan is a phony and the real statue is the exile statue. But there were others who said, the statue doesn't mean anything to us. You know, our struggle is about the border. It's about Latin America. It doesn't speak to an ocean crossing. One of the things I think is interesting to think about is whether with the fading of that European immigrant wave and its kind of cultural descendants, whether the statue will continue to hold on as a symbol that people will invoke, or whether other images will take over.
Having had three of my own grandparents pass it on the way to Ellis Island, I'll always have feelings for the old girl. But there will be other more relevant emblems of struggle. The question is, will they be as resilient? As Kramer said, the sanctuary movement was focused on the southern border, but has still laid claim to the statue's true meaning. And he notes that in the 50s, as immigrant movements talked up the benefits of admitting European refugees displaced by the war, Langston Hughes described Lady Liberty in the Chicago Defender as having her face turned to the old world, welcoming European refugees from poverty and hate, standing in New York Harbor with her back to Harlem. Hughes called on African Americans to ask the country, when will you permit us the privileges you offer Russians, Germans, Poles, and Danes who come to our shores? But then, he said, Liberty would take delight in asking those questions for you. Liberty, she's a dream, an aspiration of grace that happened to land in New York Harbor. She is not America. She's no nation. She was a gift. The rest is up to us.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chattavetti. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Special thanks to Suzanne Mannion of the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation and to Andy Lancet of the New York Public Radio Archives. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.